May I please the court? I'm Jeffrey Pagano on behalf of Mail Contractors of America. I'd like to thank this panel for its willingness to postpone the hearing given the tragedy or the events that happened when we had the hearing scheduled the first time. The fundamental issue in this case is the applicability of McClatchy to the facts of this case. And it's our position, certainly, that McClatchy has absolutely no, there's no room for McClatchy in this type of dispute. What the board decided was that all decisions or all clauses that are implemented at impasse, which provide an employer with any type of discretion, are unable to be implemented without the consent of the union. In the end, what the court, what the board did was basically ignore the teachings of American Insurance. McClatchy is built on this particular court's reconciliation of American Insurance and Bonanno. That is, in the context of the implementation after impasse doctrine, an employer can implement the final offer. The rationale is that it will encourage bargaining after a short hiatus as to the issue that's at impasse, so that in every case before this court or any other circuit, the issue in dispute was the issue implemented. Therefore, the discussion by the courts is an inquiry under a McClatchy analysis as to whether or not implementing the clause will further or destroy collective bargaining. That is the teaching most recently in this court in DuPont. The question posed in DuPont was, did it render collective bargaining impossible? So we asked the question, impossible collective bargaining on what subject? The issue here that was implemented was not the issue that was in dispute. The issue implemented here, the management rights clause and the corresponding bumping clause, was an issue already agreed to. The union had already assented to the idea. The basis of the idea, indeed, the record shows, was created in collective bargaining through a process of coordinated bargaining, where the lessons of one bargaining unit were to be taken to another bargaining unit in a joint negotiation so that one unit could have the same benefits as the other unit. In this case, the Greensboro bumping provision was borrowed and moved to Des Moines, who didn't have one. So the parties negotiated a management rights clause which added the words restructuring of runs. Moving of relay points and restructuring of runs, and the company agreed that if that occurred, employees at Des Moines could bump. In this case, or in this particular world of that dynamic, a McClatchy situation is where the issue implemented is the issue that the union has refused to agree with, and under the implementation after impasse doctrine, post-impasse, the court questions, did the clause destroy any opportunity going forward on that issue to bargain? The answer in McClatchy was, yes, it did. Why? Because a merit-based increase, which is the only exception to the implementation after impasse doctrine, would, as this court said, quote, decollectivize the unit. Indeed, what the court was saying under Bonanno, the Supreme Court decision, was if what an employer does destroys the bargaining unit, or in DuPont, destroys the opportunity for collective bargaining in some way, and in this course characterizing decollectivizes, and indeed wages decollectivize. Why? If an employer can determine which person gets which wage, the union is rendered useless. I asked the court the question, if the subject here is not wages, it's management rights. If the issue is not what was implemented, and that was what kept the parties apart. In this case, the parties had already bargained about management rights. They had already signed off. The idea of DuPont, would collective bargaining be frustrated, or under Bonanno, destruction of the union? Of course not. The union and the company already agreed on the issue. So the final issue is, on what basis can the National Labor Relations Board look at this case as a McClatchy case? What this court is doing is trying to reverse, the board is trying to reverse the entire idea of McClatchy. The original decision in McClatchy 1, this court recognized that what the board was doing was applying a waiver theory to a waiver theory. That is, the employer cannot implement a final offer unless the union consents. What that does is destroy the implementation after impasse doctrine. Now, the board would have us, in this destruction, basically believe that the entire idea is not destroyed because it still survives. Well, I ask you the question, what was the question posed in American National or American Insurance? American Insurance says the union does not have a veto power over the employer's ability to implement, propose a management rights clause. Why? Because the court acknowledged that management rights or management operating is by necessity not something that can be standardized. So the board in this case, if you take McClatchy post-MCA, what the board is saying is the only clauses that can be implemented are those that are standardized. Well, what are those clauses? Wages? Vacation? Holidays, all the things that are listed. What isn't allowed to be implemented? You will show up in the morning. You will show up when your trucking run is ready. That's vague. That requires some discretion. Indeed, it requires coordination between a truck being ready, or the employee being there, or the customer being open so you could deliver. These are all areas historically left to management because you cannot, by virtue of the operating business, particularly in trucking, you cannot visualize exactly what's going to happen. So every element of what the court discussed in American Insurance, which is historically contained in the management rights clause, the employer has the right to operate the business. That has to be negotiated under the board's rules before the employer can change opening from 9 o'clock till 10 o'clock. The employer gets to assign work. You cannot assign work without the union's consent. So what we've returned to is basically American Insurance and the idea of waiver, which was rejected by this court. The board, one of the dissenting members of the board argued that, and the ALJ argued that we deviated from past practice, and the board tries to make much of this. But the evidence in the record and the conclusions reached are simply not supported. This was a new clause that was implemented with the consent of the union. This new clause gave the employer the right to restructure runs. The past practice utilized by the ALJ was past practice. Past practice is only relevant up until impasse. That is the holdings of this court. What is relevant after implementation of impasse is, and this is in Taft Broadcasting, which is on point, what is relevant is what the employer did, contemplated by the terms of the implemented provision. We submit that changing the relay point, which quite frankly did not even break the limitations set forth in the collective bargaining agreement, is reasonably contemplated. And one final point before my time is up, and that is there unlimited discretion? There is not. The management rights clause is subject to the terms of the agreement. It is subject to arbitration. If we were prepared, and in American Insurance, they did not, it wasn't subject to the terms of the collective bargaining or the arbitration, nor is it subject to the CBA. This is a limited provision under anyone's analysis. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Brown.
May it please the court, I represent the National Labor Relations Board in this matter. It's essentially undisputed in this case that the company did change the relay point and did so without negotiation. Typically, that would be an unfair labor practice, but the company, of course, raises several defenses, including that it had implemented its final offer, that it was following past practice, that the union did not request bargaining. And the board decision goes through each of these defenses and explains why, in this case, there was no justification for the unilateral change. The company focuses obviously on McClatchy because its principal justification is that it was following the term that it implemented upon impasse. In its brief, the company talks a lot about McClatchy being limited to wages. And McClatchy, of course, is a wage case. Many, but not all of the McClatchy cases are wage cases. But in this case,
is there any case?
Yeah, what's the exception?
Yeah.
Well, DuPont and KSM are health benefit cases.
Well, that's a KSM is, that's a board decision.
That's a board decision.
What about court decisions?
DuPont is a health benefit provision.
It's a health benefit, but
it has to do with the allocation of cost.
Is DuPont reviewed
in the District of Columbia Circuit? Now, the board found, the board did not find the McClatchy exception applied in that case.
Right.
Oh, but it applied the analysis. Excuse me, I didn't mean to mislead the court.
So there's no case in which the board has extended McClatchy beyond wages with judicial approval?
Has found the exception to apply without judicial approval.
Okay.
I'm sorry, it applied the analysis and I didn't mean to miss.
And this is a wage case?
This case is not directly a wage provision as opposing counsel discussed. It has to do with setting relay points,
right.
What the board found.
So this is an extension of McClatchy.
Well, it's not a direct wage case,
right.
But I would argue that McClatchy is not limited on its terms to wages. One of the rationale McClatchy focuses on two issues. It focuses on the importance of the provision, which, and it discusses the importance of wages, and it talks a lot about the discretion afforded to the employer, the way in which that can interfere with the bargaining process. And here the board found that the relay points, because of their effect on wages and many other provisions, was in, and I don't think that this decision implies, well, in this case, the relay point, because it was changed, affected the hours, and with the hourly rate, the wages, it affected
it affected them, but it reduced the miles driven and wages earned by one driver.
And
to the exact same extent increased the miles driven and wages earned by another driver.
By another driver.
So there was no benefit to the employer's wage bill.
No, it's not an overall wage cut or raise. But, of course, in cases like McClatchy and some of the others, which are merit wage, they would affect certain employees and not affect others, presumably, though, affecting, as you say, the employer's wage bill. But I think what the board here, when it referenced the effect on wages, was pointing out, which the judge may not have pointed out as clearly, was just the importance of the relay change provision in this bargaining relationship. So where,
it was going to make the union seem futile, powerless, irrelevant?
Well, this was apparently where a scheduling change may not, I don't know, for example, at Nordstrom's may or may not be as important. Here, this change didn't just affect hours. It affected essentially the entire working conditions of the drivers. It affected where they started and finished work, which for some greatly increased their commute.
But it was an agreement the union, it was a provision the agreement had twice agreed to.
Well,
how could that possibly denigrate the collective bargaining process?
Well, I think that the company makes a lot of the union having accepted this term, and the union did what they call TA it, So it agreed that in the event that they would reach a final contract, that both parties could agree to, that this term could be part of that contract.
Wasn't this provision also in the expired collective bargaining agreement?
A similar provision was in the collective bargaining agreement.
So it had agreed to it then, as part of that agreement, and agreed to it again, so.
But.
Lived under this arrangement.
Right.
Right, but of course.
With the expired CBA, so on what ground can one say that this is life-threatening to the union?
Well, I think that, to separate out the issues, if we look at the agreement issue, company makes much of the fact that they agreed to it in the old agreement and in between, but in the old agreement, of course, this same phrase was interpreted by the parties to have a particular practice, which the company is now saying is irrelevant under the new phrase, but, you know, of course, it's a very similar item, and under the old contract, this is not at all how that clause was interpreted.
Well,
it's not
past practice, which it did involve consulting the union. That's your point, I take it.
In consulting union, it also involved changes that were essentially mandated by outside forces like the DOT or the USPS, U.S. Postal Service. And it involved some back and forth over the effects, even though there was also in that contract a clause that spoke to the effects. The fact is the practice was that the parties still discussed the effects.
And here, while there wasn't an outside requirement imposed on the company, this decision was made in order to keep operating, correct?
The initial decision was a response to the strike, but then, of course, the strike ended, and the companies
discovered that this was a more efficient way to do things.
That's the representation, but the company's only statement to the union was, it's done, it's over, there's no discussion. I mean, so at the point when the company made it permanent, there was also no notice or discussion with the union. You know, there was no discussion, there was no give and take, as the practice had been, and again, this is an internal.
In the charge, at what point is the company alleged to have run afoul of the law?
I'm glad you asked, because that's the next point I wanted to get to. It's not actually the fact that the company implemented this term that was charged. It's the actual change from York to Havelock. And the discussion of McClatchy and the term only arises as a discussion of a defense. Essentially, the company is saying this change was okay because we had this term that we'd implemented.
So yes. So in other words, it's at the moment that they made the change that's the alleged unfair labor practice.
Right. So in other words,
not when they kept it after reaching an agreement after the strike. It wasn't the fact that they kept it after the strike ended and refused to change it back. That wasn't
I don't know that the violation is separated out that specifically.
It as though it were clearly just doing this from the outset was the violation.
Well, I think that they changed the violation is the change from York to Havelock. Now, they did that during the strike, and, you know, I don't know what the board's ruling would have been if they had changed it back or if they had then backtracked and followed the practice that they had after the strike, but.
Where is the charge again?
Excuse me, I'm going to check. And I was going to look in the complaint. Or did you want the?
Perhaps Mr. Pagano.
Did we put the?
I have it, Your Honor. I believe
okay.
It's.
Oh yeah,
It's on the
JA2.
J109.
I believe it's Joint Appendix 2.
I have the charge here right before the affidavit service.
Two.
JA2.
Okay. Yeah.
All right, you're agreed on that.
I'm sorry.
And it. It charges that in or about April 2005 and continuing to date.
Right. What happened in April 2005?
I believe that was the end of the strike, although I think the year might be wrong. No, it is correct. That was the end of the strike. The strike commenced in and the change,
so
therefore,
the charge was
in
for
September.
Not changing it back.
Or I think it failed and refused to bargain, so I don't think that, you know.
For not either changing it back or bargaining.
Or bargaining about it, right. I mean, I don't know that, you know, they could have not changed it, but have still complied with the act by engaging in bargaining over it. And I think, so I'm sorry, just lost my train of thought, but the, so I.
What's the great reservation of discretion, or discretion to do what?
Well, under this clause, although there is a portion of the implemented offer that controls or limits discretion with respect to the effects, there's nothing that actually limits the, as implemented here, as applied, there's nothing that limits at all the reasons for making any change or the timing or any other.
But that was always true. You're just saying it's deep.
Although.
But they didn't put their past practice into writing?
Well, essentially.
I understand that the charge is that they didn't bargain with the union about this when the strike ended.
Right.
Returning it back, okay. But the reservation of discretion is what? That they can do this at any time?
Well, essentially, yes, they could. Apparently,
that,
at
what
any.
What do we know about that? It's the same clause as they had before, and they always talked with the union. They didn't make changes unless they were required by outside forces.
Which, of course, they didn't do here, and I guess council discusses how
they
this.
They didn't do here when they were facing the strike.
Right? Or even after the strike when they wanted, for their own convenience, to retain the move that they had done for exigencies under the strike.
Really, it's just a restatement of their refusal to bargain over this one change.
And presumably any future change, the
well,
company.
Well, we don't know. The future changes are governed by a contract that is exactly the same as the previous one, in which the past practice, apart from the strike, was to consult.
And, you know, which does bring me to the fact that even should this court decide against the board on the McClatchy issue, there still is an outstanding issue of whether this would be a violation because of not conforming to past practice, which the board didn't address. The board found.
The board only relied on the first issue, didn't it? Is that right?
Pardon me?
The board only relied. The board's decision rests only on the implementation issue, not the past practice, correct?
Well, the board.
The dissenter, or not the dissenter, the.
The concurrence.
Yeah,
or
the concurrence
footnote.
Relied on past practice, right?
Well, I think the concurrence relied entirely on past practice for a full analysis. The board adopted the ALJ decision to the extent that the ALJ found that the employer had a variety of defenses. So one defense was the implementation, and the board majority applied McClatchy. But the company also argued that it just simply was not a change because it had conformed to the status quo or past practice, and the board rejected that. So to that extent, the board did engage in a past practice analysis.
Well, was that just rejecting a defense?
Right. It was
so,
just.
So then if the board loses on McClatchy, the case is over.
Well, in effect, McClatchy is really rejecting a defense here as well, because the defense is we relied on our implemented term.
Right.
And the company talks with.
If McClatchy, if the board erred in applying McClatchy to this type of clause, then the case is over.
Well, with respect,
because
I think there's.
Because if you don't get into the past practice, then independent of McClatchy.
Well, there would be an argument that even if the board accepted the implementation of this term, that the board might still look to decide whether this change was authorized by the term and could possibly consider past practice. To the extent that we, as we've discussed, it's a similar term as the previous. Well, this is the analysis that, for example, Chairman Battista did, and that's not the board's analysis, and I'm not advocating it, but I'm just.
Is it your position then that if you lose on the McClatchy issue, the court should remand the case?
Well, that would certainly be the court's decision whether to consider it or remand it, but there, I would argue there's an outstanding issue of whether, essentially, whether the contract term that's implemented, if we accept it, does fully give the justification for the change, or whether the past practice comes into play, given, as you've noted and as the company argues, or has at some points argued, that this is a similar term to the last term, that presumably, to the extent that they're arguing there was agreement, and of course, my position is that it's not agreement until it's a final agreement on a contract, but to the extent that the parties discussed a very similar term to the term that they already had and had a practice under it, there may well have been a contemplation that that term was going to continue with the same practice that the parties had had. So I don't think that rejecting the board's finding that or holding that this term could not be implemented under the McClatchy exception would necessarily fully resolve the case.
I can hear from Mr. Pagano on that. Any further questions?
Mm-hmm. No.
Ms. Ball? All right, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Pagano, do you have any time? Well, I'd like you to just address the remand question, and if you need it, Mr. Pagano, if you need a minute for anything else, tell me.
That's okay.
Thank you.
There seems to be one.
Is Val correct that we would have to remand this case?
No, Your Honor, I think the board, in its decision, relies on McClatchy, period. It's Baptista who says, I rely solely, they used the word solely, on past practice. The board did not, the majority did not rely upon the past practice. I come back to the past practice.
What about the ALJ?
Excuse me?
What about the ALJ?
Well, the ALJ relied upon anything the ALJ could. And he relied upon McClatchy and then relied upon past practice. He relied upon both. He covered what he wanted, in our view, his decision to be.
And the opinion for the decision of the board, does it repudiate the past practice?
No, it does not. It says, and I quote, members Liebman and Walsh rely, as did the judge, on McClatchy. It's citing McClatchy. Members Liebman and Walsh observe that here, as in McClatchy, the unilateral change had a direct effect on wages. Now, there seems to be an error, I think, an assumption that's wrong here. The management rights clause that was implemented, that we operated under, is not the same clause that was in the expired CBA.
This one gives you more discretion.
Absolutely. It gives the discretion to address the issue that the judge wouldn't allow us to address, and that was the restructuring of a loan. Those words, restructuring, were put in exchange for, particularly, the bumping provision. Under the bumping provision, the evidence in the record is that the terminal was all the ones were put to bid, and those people were allowed to bump. So that clause was implemented in February 2005. So we're operating under a clause that's new from September of 2004. And that clause includes restructuring. What the ALJ and what Baptista's mistake was, and the ALJ's mistake, was very simple. They used past practice. Well, of course the local manager would say, management rights. That was his response, and that's in the record, and that's what the board alleges. Of course, because it's the new management rights clause. It says, I have the right to restructure runs. It's not limited by United States Postal Service. It's not limited to hours of service. So that's a fundamental assumption.
But how does the list relate? Well, relate this, please, to the remand question.
Well, it relates to the remand question is because the ALJ refused to allow us to put in any evidence as to practice occurring post-implementation. Under TAF, you only have to prove that it's reasonably contemplated after implementation. And you use what's known as practice. The board confused it, and basically the ALJ said, no, we're going to rely on, quote, past practice, and dug up events where the only which occurred prior to the expiration of the agreement under the old management rights clause.
Proffer with regard to
yes.
Practice under the new terms.
Yes, we made a proffer that there were 40 instances where the union wasn't consulted. That was the point. When you had, if a run was changed and no remedy to the employees under the bumping provision under the old CBA, the parties would meet. Now we do have a system. If a run is changed and it does not exceed 15% of a differential on wages, then you don't have to talk to them. That was the practice, that was the terms in Greensboro that the union, and it's in the record, that the union suggested. So the judge and the board basically failed to permit us to put in any practice evidence. And I would just close, Your Honor, with the one word from McClatchy, and I think it goes to the issue, the subject of wages. McClatchy itself says, and I quote, "We think the board is free to draw upon its expertise to determine that wages are typically of paramount importance in collective bargaining, and to suggest that wages, unlike scheduling or a host of other decisions generally thought closely tied to management operations, comma, are expected to be set bilaterally. The parties, by their conduct, by agreeing to that clause, said that they weren't to be set bilaterally." Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Please submit.